Hey there, Fat Joy listeners. Did you know there's a mental health practice in Canada that is specifically for fat folks? Tend and Cultivate Counseling was created by and for fat people. It's a place that offers non-stigmatizing fat-centric mental health care, whether you want to talk about your body or not. They specialize in body trust, self-compassion, body liberation, eating disorders, relationships, sex, pleasure, and trauma. So if you're looking for mental health care that understands the complexities of navigating life in a fat body, head to tendandcultivate.com/fatjoy. Or you can give episode 57 of the Fat Joy podcast a listen to hear my interview with their founder, Dawn Sarah. My partner and I actually worked with Dawn and got some really helpful relationship support when we needed it. And good news, they see clients outside of Canada too. Fat Mental Health Matters and Tend and Cultivate Counseling is here to support you. Get the website link in this episode show notes to tendandcultivate.com/fatjoy and prioritize your mental health. Hello, lovelies. Welcome to the Fat Joy podcast, where we talk each week about how to flourish in an anti-fat world. I'm Sophia Apostle, a fat professional coach who loves talking to other fat people about what it's like to live within oppressive systems that marginalize our bodies and how we still dare to have the audacity and courage to reach towards our collective liberation and embrace our joy. Please know this is an adult content podcast, so there will be swears, we will be talking about harms we've experienced, and we will be rebelling against weight stigma, diet culture, fat phobia, ableism, racism, etc. You can get more Fat Joy goodness, including how you can support the podcast, through my newsletter at fatjoy.substack.com. And for episode transcripts, book reviews, and show notes, head to the Fat Joy website at fatjoy.life. I am so glad you're here. Enjoy this episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome back to the Fat Joy podcast. I, of course, am your host, Sophia, and I have someone that I'm so excited to talk to today. I have Mary Lambert. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
We've already been talking. I was like, we should probably record. So, Mary, tell us a little about yourself.
Okay, so my name is Mary Lambert. I'm originally from Seattle, Washington, Everett, Washington, that area. I live in Western Massachusetts now. I'm probably most known for singing the song Same Love with Macklemore. And I'm 2-time Grammy nominated, multi-platinum selling artist. So I love having all of that in my, you know, in my back catalog of who I am and my identity. But also, all of that was sort of built on, you know, a principle of vulnerability and messaging and really caring about social justice and social issues. And that is at the core of who I am. And so I have always felt that my identity is so intrinsic to the art that I make. So it makes sense that, you know, a natural progression for me would be in sort of a fat positivity sphere. So I'm kind of doing stuff related to that. I'm in a Netflix series called Arlo the Alligator Boy and I Heart Arlo, playing like a fat character. So that's fun. And I have been composing for film. So doing composition and fun stuff like that. So kind of doing lots of different things that excite me. And I'm in the middle of working on an album. And those are the things.
Those are the things. Oh, yes. I mean, you also, you know, spoken to the UN, no big deal. There's so many things that you do. When I was reading up a little bit about you, I could see, like, it feels like, and tell me if this is wrong, my assumption was that this is someone who is really following her heart towards things that feel important to her. And it wasn't like, no, I'm a singer and I only sing. It was like, no, I'm going to, like, go where I feel I can have impact, is what my takeaway was from reading your extensive bio.
It's spot on. I feel like I can't do a project if my heart is not fully in it, or if I don't see some sort of greater utility to it. And I wish that I could just make art sometimes just for the sake of making art, but I've always made art to survive and art to heal. And So as a tool for that. So in any facet of my artistic expression, it's about healing and caring for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I imagine had to start with you first, which leads beautifully into my next question, which is always your journey with the word fat. What was that like for you?
Yes. Oh, it's such a good question. Because when I first did Same Love, so this was probably about 10 years ago, I had gotten to the place where I had just realized I had, I wouldn't have called it an eating disorder, but I definitely dealt with disordered eating. And I realized that I was like making myself sick. I was making myself miserable. I was really chasing this sort of this smaller body that I had when I was 16, which is just weird to chase a body that you had when you were literally a child. I realized that in that pursuit of like trying to be healthy, I was actually like really damaging myself and creating really harmful behaviors and just a poor life for myself. And so I got to this place where I was like, okay, I think this might be the size that I am forever. Can I get comfortable with that? And so I started being like, I'm a curvy lady. I'm a big girl. I'm voluptuous. I'm, you know, yeah. Rubenesque, whatever.
Yeah. All the words, all the euphemisms we use. Yeah.
And I remember I was with my friend Kim Selling, who I love. I'm just so glad that we're in the same world. She's, she has an online store called Heavy Duty Vintage. Yeah, they're just awesome. Kim and I were at dinner and they said, oh, you know, because we're fat, something, something, because we're both fat. And I was like, I didn't say anything because I was like, I know she's right, but okay, can I, you know, I'm like, I know she meant like we're in community with each other. Like we're, you know, we're similar body size and I'm working through this. And I kind of sat with it for a while. And I was like, did it upset me? No. Okay. It like what made me pause about it? And I realized the things that maybe made me bristle were issues that I had with the culture, were issues that I had with society that really didn't reflect how I actually felt about the word. Once I started recognizing that it was just a character descriptor and it was just something that was actually quite neutral, it became part of my vocabulary. And I also really liked that it, the same way that it kind of made me go, oh, can we say that? It was, I liked doing that to other people. Like I was like, ooh, really contagious. That sort of radical, progressive feeling of saying like, no, this is just actually something neutral. And the more that we're afraid of it, the less normalized it is, and that is it's to be feared. So I don't want my body size to be something that's feared. And I think also there is a stage, you know, where it's like, do I call myself that if I don't feel like other people read me that way? So I think by her saying that, it was like, I read you this way. And it helped me, I think, a little bit, because for a while I'd sort of teetered between straight sizes and plus sizes and was like, I don't know if I would call myself that because I don't know if other people would call me that. So I think that's another case of like identity, character descriptors, being like, how do other people see me and how do I see myself, and coming to an agreement internally about that.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned the piece around how now you get to kind of pay it forward and shock people sometimes. It is a fun part of reclaiming the word.
It's like handing someone a key, like just being like, do you know that this is okay?
Well, and I'm so curious about the part where you go through this journey of reclamation, of getting really comfortable within your own skin. I'm not sure if at this point you're kind of singing about it, like what shows up in some of your albums at this point. But you're also a celebrity, right? So there is this whole Hollywood culture around basically as thin as possible. We know, it's no secret, you know, there are a lot of celebrities right now having Ozempic parties and everyone's trying to get as thin as possible. And that, in, you know, it reinforces all of diet culture tropes, and there's just this whole industry behind it. And then you in the public eye as something that is considered, you know, fearful by so many others. Like, how do you reconcile those two? I can't even imagine having to walk that path.
It's been a journey. I think, you know what? I think it's gotten worse over the last couple of years. I think it's gotten more painful for people who are more in the public sphere. I think I played the game for a while. You know, I feel like I spent half of my time in LA and half of my time in New York. And I think being in those environments and, you know, working with a record label and, you know, the team that I had at Capitol was Katy Perry's team. So it was like, I felt like I was expected to be Katy Perry and to do all the things that she did. And there was a lot of pressure to be this sort of digestible version of myself and being proud of my size or who I was or my body felt like a too much of a challenge about all of the things that I was already doing. So it seemed like it was kind of like pick the gay thing or pick the fat thing. You can't do both the thing. You know, it may not have ever been verbalized that way, but it definitely felt that. I was told to not perform certain songs at certain events and make people uncomfortable, or, you know. So I got a taste of it. In 2015, when I stopped working with Capitol Records, I'm like, I left the label or they dropped me, whatever. However I want to frame it in the moment. I feel like I walked away from a little bit of that. And, you know, living in Western Massachusetts, it's just like queer heaven. And I feel like I'm not really in that space. I think online, I still feel connected in some way, but I think it's just a different world now. I don't know how other people experience it. I think maybe because I've been so involved in fat positivity and this stuff, people know not to bring their bullshit to me. They know not to fuck with me about it. So I don't face that kind of thing. The only pressure that I would experience would be some sort of external, like, you know, I'm seeing this thing. Do I want that? And I'm so far, you know, developed in my sense of self and identity that it's just not even appealing, you know, anymore. I'm like, I actually really love my body size. So anything that would, you know, interfere with that self-love and, you know, care for my own experience and body is just doesn't really matter to me. But I think when I think about artists that are younger or artists that are more in the mix, I really worry for them. And I really feel for people that are sort of battling this stage of hostility on bodies that don't fit the norm, you know?
It sounds like, Mary, you've not removed yourself, but you're really clear on what you'll say yes and no to. And if there's any ask for a compromise of who you are and how you want to be, it's a clear no for you. Is that kind of what you've come to?
It's true. And I think I've had to make, I've definitely had to make sacrifices where I'm like,
yeah,
I'm like, I could do this thing and we would be able to fix the heat or, you know, or like, or not. And sometimes I kind of kick myself because I'm like, am I too stubborn? Like, am I too, you know, committed to this thing where maybe if I just like bent a little bit in my, you know, ethical, you know, like orientation that I might have it a little easier. So I don't, you're asking something that I've been thinking about a lot is like, do I have any moral flexibility? Because it would make things a lot easier if I could just, you know, if I was just like, yeah, I'll do an influencing. But I'm like, I don't want to, you know, I feel like it's something I'm chewing on.
Yeah. I really feel this tension. I feel like this is what people who want to live a more social justice, anti-oppressive focused life, we butt up against late stage extractive capitalism. So, like, it's designed so perfectly to make it very difficult to separate yourself. So, oh,
I think even down to this, there's like at least the thing that I think I deal the most with is this sort of insecurity with promotion and like being in marketing and being like, oh God, I feel so skeezy being like, buy this thing or do this thing. And I'm like, I don't know how to just be like, it's, I don't know. Here I am. I'm trying to sell you something. Like, it just doesn't feel good. And I don't know how. I mean, I guess that's why people have companies, because they can just be like, it's my company and it's not me. But for so much of this, it's me. And so it just feels different. It's a different shade of it. And it's, you have to kind of compartmentalize that and be like, this is my livelihood. And this is my, you know, this is also a product that I make. One of my favorite poets, Chen Chen, had a really eye-opening tweet. It was like a tweet from like a year or two ago. And he was like, a lot of artists feel like it's selfish to do self-promotion online, but it's actually far more selfish to believe that they're just, that your audience is just going to go to your website and know what you're doing. It's like the kindest, you know, most generous thing to your audience is to make it very easy for them to find you and support you. And I've been really trying to embody that and be like, that's good. That's good to know. It's good to put yourself out there and share your things.
Yes. This is actually something I've spent a lot of time thinking about as well. I'm going to connect you with, or I'll send you the website for Kelly Deals, who I've actually interviewed on the podcast. I studied with her about this exact same thing, especially because I come from a sales background, which is rooted in creating false urgency and having people feel scarcity in order to create pain points that they will then, you know, and take my money, fix me, right? As opposed to what Kelly does, which is basically a feminist approach to marketing that is rooted in anti-oppression. And like, I don't know if you want to check that out or if you've ever looked into that, but I found it allowed me, and I'm still working on it. I struggle with it and I seek help from people who have studied in that so that we can offer what we have to offer in a way that feels aligned and good and not extractive. And then people can make a really empowered yes, as opposed to feeling like, oh God, I'm scared if I don't do this, something bad will happen to me. That's what I don't want to keep perpetuating.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, yeah. So shout out to Kelly Deals. I'll send you her email or her and her website. I have a question. I asked some listeners, like, if you were to have a question for Mary Lambert, what would it be? And I got this really wonderful one from Amanda Sabater. And here it is. And I thought I'm so curious to see what you think of this. So what do you think about the process of transmuting fat pain into fat resilience? And what role does art play in the process?
Ooh, what a good question.
Right? I'm like, that's a great Mary Lambert question.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I did this series for Wondrium, which is like, you know, like a learning, it's like a Netflix for like education. And the episode that I was a part of was basically about sublimation of like, you know, how do you turn, you know, this like suffering into art and, you know, make something more beautiful out of struggle. And I think because of my upbringing, so I was raised in a really traumatic environment, and I dealt with childhood abuse and incest and, you know, just really unsafe experiences. And so much of my practice of art was a practice of self-soothing and making music and art for the wound and caring for myself when I didn't feel safe. So that practice started when I was 5. Like the first song I wrote was like, was, you know, on a little Casio keyboard, like under my bed going, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. And giving myself that safety just with my voice instructed me to now about the power of that. And so whenever I have dealt with any kind of hardship, whether it be, you know, dealing with the behavioral issues that come from having bipolar disorder or, you know, sexual trauma or, you know, the unfairness and experience of being fat, it is all, I feel I am afforded a joyful life because I'm able to put it somewhere. Music is a container for me to put that. And when I do that, I'm able to live this full, vibrant life because I've contended with this, because I've contended with the hurt. And so art has been central to it. Like art, I feel like I would not be here if I didn't have the ability to create. I have so many feelings all the time. And so being able to have a place to sort of put it, you know, if I'm really in a dangerous place or I just don't feel safe, I mean, there I am at the keyboard, there I am at the piano, there I am with my voice, you know, finding safety in myself. And it is this thing that no one can ever take away from me. No one can ever take that away from me. It's such, I'm so grateful. And I wish everybody had that experience and could do that because it's such a gift. Like I think about my experience. I'm like, it's such a gift that I was offered and that I also facilitated and continued to nurture for myself. Thank God for that. I wish everybody had that. And especially thinking about, you know, the experience of being fat and just feeling really isolated and alone, especially as a kid, and finding some place to put that. I also think music facilitated the external validation as well, because you have the insular sort of, I'm going to heal myself, I'm going to care for myself. But then the sharing, the other end of that process is like, you will hear this message coming from my body and you're going to like it. And so that forces people to be like, I like you and you happen to be fat, you know, or whatever. And so you have to reckon with my humanity. You have to reckon with my identity, whether you want to or not. I'm here in this body and I'm demanding it, you know?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love this rebellious, like kind of not combative. What's the word? Like you're going to call people in.
Yeah. It is confrontational.
Yeah, confrontational. That's the word. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, but it's also so powerful because you are refusing to be invisibilized. You are refusing to have any of your marginalizations take you out of the conversation. And I mean, God, we need that. We need people doing that. And you also beautifully then do it for others because you have created Everybody is a Babe and you run workshops. So tell us a little bit about how you help others. Yeah, but how you help others step into their own liberation journey so that they, I just imagine these ripple effects happening. So then they shift their lives, their relationships, they don't let other people invisibilize them, and it just spreads. So tell us a little bit about what you do there.
I hope so. Like, I hope that's the effect. You know, as I was talking and as we're talking about like sublimation and the act of, you know, music being this mechanism of healing for me, I think I did get to a place, especially around like 2019, 2018, where I was like, I love making music and I love this process. I had just done the voice acting thing for Netflix. And I was like, I want to connect with people. I think around 2017, 2018, I had a stalker. And so I was dealing with this real fear of people. And I had previously, you know, had an experience where I felt my environment was very controlled. And I was just fearful of people. I was paranoid. I was suspicious. And when I would spend time with, you know, celebrities that had like really big followings, that was one really common theme that I saw with, you know, my friends in the industry, that they were just really paranoid and really suspicious and had to be kind of on high alert and super guarded in order to be safe. But some of it was like, it just kind of infects your brain and you can't live a normal life because you're just always scared. Hyper
vigilant. Yeah. Like that, holding that level is, that has such a negative impact on our.
Yes. And I think that was part of, honestly, why I started to run away from that kind of exposure or saturation in the industry was like, whatever that is, I don't want that. That freaks me out. So I started realizing like, oh, I want to sing music to, you know, I want to sing and yeah, do music and create a lot of different art. And I want money and I want all this stuff and I want recognition and I want, you know, the accolades, but I don't want fame. I don't want that. Whatever that is that's an infection. Like that's scary to me. And so I was like, how do I get all the positives and none of the negatives? How do I navigate that? And the feeling that I was having was like, I don't want to be suspicious of people anymore. And I had really distanced myself even from things online where I was like, I'm not even going to comment on someone else's comment or engage with people that are engaging with my work. I am going to keep myself totally separate and out of it. And then I just started feeling really disconnected. I started feeling like I was already kind of feeling isolated. I was going through a breakup. I was just feeling really alone. I feel like I didn't really have a community. And I wanted to do something that felt more tangible, that I could say I'm helping, not just in this sort of nebulous way because people hear my music and they're moved by it, but like I want to be in front of someone like helping, you know?
Yeah. I want to be in the room and I want to see the impact.
Yes, totally. So I think in many ways, like starting the workshop was a little selfish of like, I want to see what I can do. And I want to help people because I would get comments and emails and, you know, people sending me like handwritten letters from, you know, eating disorder treatment that were like, you have done so much for me just with this song. At that point, I'd been on this sort of 10-year journey from that moment where I was like, okay, I'm dealing with disordered eating. I have to get to a place where I'm comfortable with myself. That journey to where I ended up, and obviously there's no sort of like destination, but I do feel like I'm in body euphoria now. Like I'm in like self-love, body love euphoria. Like it really is like I'm in nirvana. So that's what that's in it. And it's not to say that that's not challenged or I have to, you know, I don't deal with things, but when I'm dealing with hurts or pain or the frustrations of being in a bigger body, it's like those frustrations, they live so much shorter in my brain and they're just fewer and far between. And so developing the workshop started from a book that I wanted to write that I'm like, am I ever going to write it? I don't know. partially because in the poetry world is where I met Sonia Renee Taylor. And Sonia, we met in like 2012 doing like a poetry event, like at night, this like guerrilla poetry event. And I just was like, whoever this person is, like, I love her. And then I continued to follow her and was just like, you know, The Body Is Not an Apology was such a pivotal, you know, work for me. And when I read her book in like 2015, 2014, she kept mentioning that she had done a workshop. And I was like, I wonder if I can, before I write my book, maybe it would be good to see if some of these approaches and these exercises that I've done for myself are actually practically helpful before I'm like, this is the way to do it. You know, what other things can I learn, especially from other people that are like, this works for me, this doesn't work for me. And so that's when the workshop sort of developed. And I read a lot, I researched a lot, and I spent about a year developing the workshop itself. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't causing harm. I wanted to make sure that I was like, you know, really listening to the right voices, that I was like, you know, when I started doing the work, I was like, oh, disability justice. Like, Black Lives Matter. Oh, like there's so many different facets to thinking about identity and where, you know, anti-fat bias really comes from. And it alerted me to all of these different, you know, limbs of this. And I'm so grateful I did that before I wrote the book, because I wouldn't have had that exposure or that awareness of that lens. So the workshop has been awesome. I've done about 8 cycles of it. And right now I'm developing like a self-paced course. And hopefully that's going to be out in like in December sometime. Whenever it's done, I'm still working on it. Watch, it'll be like 2025. And then I'm thinking of doing another cycle of the workshop in May. So it's just been such a part of my heart and something that really, really makes me happy. And to be able to see that, you know, effect has been so incredible.
Yeah. Oh, it's so, I've said this before, but it's so needed. I mean, when I think about my own beginnings of my own journey, it was, you know, people like Sonia Renee Taylor, Lindy West, Jess Baker, Virgie Tovar, like all of these people who were speaking openly and publicly, that the permission they gave themselves gave me the permission to even take a look and be like, hang on, am I just suffering for no reason? What? And so having your voice added to the chorus of fat liberation is just, it's so powerful. And I think, I have to hope, I don't know, I feel really hopeless about the world most of the time. But when I have these conversations with guests, I think, oh, there's another person doing amazing work. And I really try to focus on the ripple effect that's having, and having people question diet culture in a bigger way, understanding the mechanisms behind it, the money driving it. So thank you for creating a workshop. I love that there's going to be a self-paced kind of async version. That's going to be really wonderful. The other thing that you're really vocal about is mental health. What had you, so this is, so, and I may not ask this question properly, but I'm going to ask it because I think it's, I'm really curious about it. So being fat is very visible, right? Like people can see it on your body. Mental health, less so. So you kind of stepping forward, talking very publicly about mental health. I mean, you and your partner have a whole wonderful podcast called The Manic Episodes. Your album Grief Creature is all about shame and mental health. I was re-listening to the song Secrets and I was like, God, I love this song so much. And the song Shame is incredible. And so what had you really want to step forward and talk about mental health? And what did it require of you to even be able to do that?
You know, it's funny because I think all of these things, my relationship to fat positivity and fat liberation was really tied up in my relationship with mental health, because all of it really centered around shame and how shame complicates things and really obfuscates like our ability to see things clearly and to find love and find community, because we're so fucking scared and we feel ashamed about our identity or things that have happened to us or things that are beyond our control. Or even if it is within our control, like there's still like all of these barriers to finding community and finding joy, that there's some sort of prerequisite to, like, you must suffer in order to have some story or in order to, you know, pay your dues, you know, I don't know. And I think when I started working on my first full-length album, On Hard on My Sleeve, I was working with, this was back on the label, so there was like two producers and two songwriters, and we were like sitting in the recording studio, and I remember we wrote Secrets like in one day, and I remember writing that first lyric of like, you know, having the first line be, I have bipolar disorder. And I was like, this is so awesome. This is so powerful. This is going to be great. And I woke up the next morning after we recorded it and I was like, oh, fuck.
Oh, vulnerability hangover.
Oh, no, exactly. I was like, what have I done? I am basically, because I felt my fear was, if I talk about my mental health and I talk about that I'm mentally unstable, then it's going to seem like every queer person is mentally unstable. That, and if I talk, and the same, honestly, the same side of this coin is like, if I talk about my childhood abuse and experiencing early childhood sexual abuse, and I talk about being fat, someone's going to make some sort of bullshit connection that is not there. And so there was this fear that like I needed to be some sort of holy spokesperson that was like presenting this, you know, very clear, pure, canned narrative about one aspect of my identity. Once I started to accept that like, oh, everybody's complicated, everybody's complex and has different facets to their identity, we're just taught that we're supposed to make that into something, you know, digestible for other people. And the way that my brain is and the way that my body is doesn't have to be legible to other people, as long as it's clear for me. And if I can communicate that in a way, whether it's with my art or directly in a poem or to, you know, in a speech, then that's what it is for me. And it's not my responsibility to control what other people think about me. Like my responsibility is here with myself. And I knew too, talking about mental health, specifically talking about bipolar disorder, I had never seen some sort of positive representation of someone who had bipolar disorder. It was like people that were like absolutely unhinged and, you know, and had these really, you know, painful lives of suffering. And while it's not all sunshine and roses, you know, to be, you know, to have a mental disorder, or have something like bipolar disorder. It's far more rich and vibrant, and there's so much more joy than this narrative. And it would be fine if those narratives existed, if there were just more complex ones out in the world. So yes. I wanted to provide this thing where it's like, yeah, this is an aspect about me. It doesn't fully define who I am. It just might explain some of this erratic behavior every so often.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. And again, similar with fatness too, right? The image that's projected of fatness is you basically walk around. It's like, you know, that movie, The Whale, you know, it's the worst thing. You're going to die. No. Let's have more complexity and nuance and show fat people thriving. And yeah. I love that word that you use, digestible. Yeah, like we don't have to be digestible to others. That's not our responsibility. Oh, so Mary, let's talk about joy. How do you connect to joy?
I connect to joy by embracing all parts of myself, by connecting with others in that complexity and being able to be my full self with other people is like the sheerest joy that I've ever experienced, of having my identity and my happiness and my interests and my whole self be validated by people I'm around, and not feeling I have to temper any part of who I am in order to please someone else or make someone else feel comfortable. I think that is radical love. And so I feel that kind of joy when I'm able to express that and have that be mirrored.
Oh yeah. Amazing. Oh, you are incredible. I'm so inspired by you, Mary. And we are also lucky because you're going to read us a poem of yours. I always read a poem at the end of the podcast. And when I found out that you had a book of poetry, several books of poetry, actually, you graciously agreed to read one of yours to close this episode.
So excited.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this is from my book, Shame is an Ocean I Swim Across. And it's so funny. I love that you read a poem at the end of your episodes. We do that on our podcast too.
Yes.
And I just love that. It's like being able to...
It's like another way to connect to what has just been experienced. I don't know. There's something alchemizing and magical about poetry that it just works at a different level.
It's that same sort of function that I think music has for healing trauma. I think poetry and writing in this way has been so helpful for me for caring for my body and writing about my body in a way that feels empowering. So this is a poem I wrote reading that quote from one of Oprah's editors about that only thin people should be wearing crop tops. So I wrote this sort of, the format is in a style of it looks like biblical text. It's called Jesus Loves My Crop Top. 1, I like my belly button. 2, my belly button does not interrupt your life. 3, why do you hate so much my belly button? 4, is it maybe because someone was mean to your belly button? 5, I'm sorry someone was mean to your perfect belly. 6, you cannot love what you hope your body turns into without loving it for what it is right now. 7, when I was in high school, I obsessively fantasized about taking a knife to my stomach like a bagel slicer. 8, one night I found a website that just had photos of girls with stomach rolls and back rolls, and they were smiling, and I cried because I was uncomfortable and envious of their joy. 9, I used to drink a fifth of tequila and smoke a pack of cigarettes every night. 10, no one criticized my health then. 11, my body is what it is, what it is. 12, the mirror is what it is, what it is. 13, celebrating your body is a revolutionary act. 14, I feel my own self breathe. I feel my organs when I breathe and when I shower. I feel my skin on my skin. I know that it is mine. I listen to what my body asks for. I put on a shirt that shows my stomach. I wing my eyeliner up and I ride my bike into the sunset and I will pick wildflowers with my love and later I will eat Brussels sprouts and maybe a martini with lots of olives in it. And I will do all this because it makes me feel good and because I am worthy of love and cute clothes and happiness. 15, feeling worthy has taken a very long time. 16, I am my own holy revolution. Welcome to the church of my thunder thighs. I am awake and alive. I've come to wear all of the crop tops that the glittering world has to offer. I've come to dance the shame out of my childhood. I've come to win back my joy. You may not snatch it from me like a purse. 17, I win whether I have a mouthful of pretzels or a mouthful of kale. You have not been granted the privilege to know how I consume my world and what makes me most delight in my skin. I will glorify the shit out of my body.
Oh. I could weep right now. Oh my God. That's so powerful, Mary. Oh. Thank you so much for reading that to us. What an absolute privilege. And thank you for talking to me. This has been amazing. I feel so honored to have gotten to know you.
Thank you. Thank you for this time and the space. And, you know, I feel like I've been so focused on music for the last couple months. And it's really, really nice to dive back in and talk about something that matters so much to me. And honestly, an honor to be here. You have interviewed some incredible people and, you know, you are an incredible person yourself and the work that you've done. And I thank you. I thank you for this space.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today. My hope is that you're feeling a little less alone and a little more seen. So until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at fatjoy.life, on YouTube at youtube.com/@fatjoy, and on Substack at fatjoy.substack.com. And please do check out the episode notes for how you can connect with my amazing guest and for the links to the poem. All right, lovely, I am sending you off with my best wishes for an abundantly fat joy day, and we'll talk again soon.